Okay, before I get started, let me thank the organizers for inviting me, for the kind hospitality here at Vancouver. I'm going to present some work or report on some ongoing work collaboration with Matthias Staudacher, who's also here, based on two papers, one also with Gleb Avotyunov, which came out last year. Okay, so, well, it has been a long-sought old dream to study gauge theories in the large end limit while keeping the so-called Toft coupling, which is this combination of G squared, G the coupling constant, fixed, in which the theory reduces to the sum of its planar diagrams, and one hopes to establish some dual description of it. I don't think it's just the switch.
You could use this other one.
Huh? You think?
Well, maybe the other one would go.
So that would shut off when it gets hot.
Now it works at least. I just
maybe this is
okay. Good, so I can work with two now. All right. And of as many of us here in the audience know, there is, more or less for the first time ever, a rather concrete proposal of how such a thing is established for the very special gauge theory of n equals 4 super Young-Mills in four dimensions, which is conjectured to be described by the type to be superstring in an ADS5 cross S5 background. And especially if we look at the low-energy supergravity limit of that string theory, that should correspond to the large-end limit of the UN super Young-Mills in the sector of strong Toft coupling lambda. And to have a feeling of what we're talking about here, this is a super Young-Mills theory augmented by four gluinos and six scalar fields, all in the joint representation, and the action looks like this. So I have just the standard kinetic term for the scalars, and then I also have a quartic interaction sitting right here. Okay, so I shall be interested in a specific class of operators in this theory, which are generalizations of the Wilson loop operator, and we decided to call them Maldacena Wilson loops because they are defined right here. Up to here, this is just the ordinary story for Wilson loops. I have a path-ordered exponential of the gauge potential. I now also add a coupling to the scalars, to the six scalars, in such a fashion that the theta I is just squares to one. So when I move in the four-dimensional space on my path, I also perform a path on the S5 with velocity given exactly by the mod of x dot. And I want to stress that this operator is non-unitary because I'm missing an I at this point here. So this is, from the type 2B superstring point of view, a very natural operator because in the dual supergravity description, it actually corresponds to the an open string world sheet ending on the boundary of ADS5, and the contour prescribed on that boundary is just the curve described in that Wilson loop operator, and the value of that operator is given by the extremal world sheet in this geometry. So for various geometries I've listed the result here. It always goes like, so the expectation value of that Lanczos-Hadley-Wilson loop operator in the strong coupling limit always goes like e to the square root of lambda, lambda again the Tuft coupling, times a is the area, and for, now I've just highlighted three geometries here, an infinite line, a is actually zero, and w is just given by one. For a circle, a is one, so it's going like e to the square root of lambda, and let me stress that n is 4 super Young-Mills is a conformal theory. That's why there is no dependence on the radius of that circle in the result, as it should be. Similarly, if I look at a rectangle in the limit where sort of this length t is much larger than L, in that limit it corresponds to two antiparallel lines, infinitely extending antiparallel lines. A is given by this funny expression. Again, the conformality forces me to have such a dimensionless combination, so T over L, and I have this very interesting numerical factor up front. So this is the supergravity prediction in the limit, in the large lambda limit, and a natural question to ask now is what can we say about these operators from the Young-Mills side, from the conformal field theory side, and in particular, can we perhaps even reproduce that result? So there has been some very nice work by Erickson, Semenov, and Sarembo on this subject, who studied now the perturbative side of this question. So for small values of lambda, they looked at the first graphs in this problem, and the results are rather tantalizing because the first observation is that one can actually complete a complete sum over a subsector of graphs in the theory, that is, over so-called ladder graphs, which are graphs with whose properties on the loop, and there are no internal interaction vertices involved. So for an infinite line and for the circle, one can actually sum up all these graphs, and the result one obtains is 1 for the line and e to the square root of lambda for the circle in the limit that lambda is very large, and that exactly agrees with the supergravity prediction. Now, of course, this is only a subsector of graphs, and
Does this mean no cross lines also?
Yeah, no cross lines. So no interaction vertices. No 3-point, no 4-point.
I meant in the ladder sum, no cross lines.
No.
Oh, that's that's down by large n limit.
Large n limit, it's down.
Sorry.
But yeah, and you have a full, yeah. you have an exact result here for all values of lambda and n. But I'm just looking at the large n and large lambda limit. So that's all. Okay, so of course this is not a gauge invariant statement here. One has to include the vertex graphs. It turns out, however, that at leading order, these vertex graphs vanish. So at order g to the 4, this and this graph is identically to 0, whereas these two graphs sum up to 0. So an obvious question now is does this cancellation extend to all orders, and does the Maldacena result really describe just the sum of all planar diagrams? And have we succeeded in performing this sum in the strong coupling limit? On the other hand, it would also be a little bit of a take back, because that would mean, if that is really true, that the Maldacena result is really just capturing a very special sector of a gauge theory, that is a sort of hidden free sector in which only ladder graphs contribute. So it would be very interesting or very desirable to say more on this, how this continues, this cancellation here, for the line and for the circle from the supergravity potential, from the gauge theory side. And also, what can we, next question that arises, of course, what can we say about the static potential whose supergravity prediction looks like this? Okay, so another development shortly thereafter was by a paper by Drucker and Gross, who actually conjectured that the result I showed you for the circle is exact to all orders for generic values of lambda and n, not only in the large n and large lambda limit, and that all vertex graphs should cancel. So we only have the contribution from these ladder diagrams, and that this circular Wilson loop is actually described by a zero-dimensional field theory, by a matrix model, a free matrix model, a Gaussian matrix model, and the correlator, the loop correlator, circular Wilson loop correlator, is just given by this integral here. So this is a very strong statement. How it's a conjecture. So, but they gave a. Well, in the first version, I think they said they had a proof, but then they just, in the second version of a paper, they took this back, but they have an argument, or a line of arguments why this should be so. And the argument runs about like this. So they start out from the infinite line, which is argued to be a BPS object, and from which one deduces that it's that the expectation value for the lines went 1 to all orders, so there are no perturbative corrections. It's exactly 1 to in perturbation theory, which nobody has proven, but let's take this as a starting point. Then we perform an inversion, which is a conformal transformation, which maps the infinite line to a circle, and then, I mean, in principle, this would mean if a theory is conformally invariant, then the results shouldn't change. However, we know just by explicit computations on the perturbative side or from the supergravity side that the expectation value of a line is not equal to the circle. So what goes wrong? They argued that this is due to a conformal anomaly because is related to the fact this inversion actually induces total derivative terms in the propagator which pick up contributions at infinity under this transformation. So they argued that only the ladder graphs are sensitive to this so-called conformal anomaly, and that the vertex graphs should not be affected by it and should remain zero. The way it is set up in the paper is that it's a graph by graph argument, so I should be able to compare graph by graph under this map, because what they did is they studied how the propagators transform. So we'll take a closer look at this in the following. So let's have first a closer look on perturbative n is 4d equals 4 super Yang-Wells theory. The first important statement is that the theory is believed to be completely finite. However, that does not mean that non-gauge invariant expectation value, like, for example, the one-loop self-energy, is finite. It turns out to actually diverge. So it would be given, if I look at the gluon self-energy correction, you have gluons, scalars, gluinos, and ghosts contributing, and this thing diverges. But that's not so surprising, because it's a non-gauge invariant object. However, even gauge invariant expectation values can be singular. An example is the standard Wilson loop operator, where I do not have these scalar fields contributing. And that is just due to the fact that if propagators together here, at this point, pick up a divergence which is proportional to the length of the Wilson loop, and normally taken into account by a mass renormalization of the particle running around the loop. But this is also present in N is 4 super Yang-Wells theory, these divergences. However, the specific form of this Malda-Sena Wilson loop operator, where I add in the scalar coupling, is believed to, or to this order, perturbation theory also proven to be finite. So this problem that one encounters, the divergence of this operator does not appear for the Malthus-Sander-Wilson loop. But then there are also arguments by Gross and Noguri that this should be always the case. A technical remark is how to deal on intermediate steps with divergences is that we calculate by dimensional reduction. We regulate dimensional reduction. That is, we consider a super Young-Wells theory in, say, two omega dimensions, in which one has a 2 omega component gauge field, 10 minus 2 omega scalars, and 16 fermions. And then, in the end, let's omega go to zero. And here one sees, because one has divergences on in individual graphs in these computations, that there's a potential problem for the Gross-Stroker argument, which works on a graph-by-graph basis. Because on intermediate steps, I have to leave the conformal domain of the theory in order to regulate my graphs, and then all these conformal maps are certainly flawed. So let's keep on going and try to understand how one could actually sum up all these all the ladder graphs, which I have been saying at the beginning. So let's look at a loop-loop propagator, that is a propagator which starts on the Wilson loop and ends on the Wilson loop. And I'm also going to always work in a sort of combined language where I combine the gluon and the scalar propagators, which couple together to the Malthus-Sander-Wilson loop in one wiggly line, one blue wiggly line. So in Feynman gauge, which is rather it is advantageous to work in Feynman gauge here, because then the propagators of the gluons and the scalars look the same. Such a propagator starting and ending on the Wilson loop takes this form. So here, well, up here this was in four dimensions. Here is the dimension regulated expressions in two omega dimensions. So this contribution here comes from the gluon sector. This contribution from the scalar sector. Remember, the gluons were coupling with x dot a mu, and this was coupling with the mod of x dot, the scalars. So this is this is the form of that propagator, and one immediately sees now that if I look at a ladder graph on the infinite line, starting and ending on the line, this expression actually is just equal to zero, because this product is equal to that on the line. And that means that the propagator is identically to zero before I even started integrating these two points along the propagator. So that immediately implies that the sum of all ladder diagrams for the infinite line is just one. I mean, there's no further correction to this, just the starting one of the expanding the exponential. Now, even nicer is the story for the circle, because if one actually works out the algebra here, in four dimensions, omega is equal to 2, these two contributions cancel for the circle, and the result is just a constant, 1 over 8 pi squared, again, for arbitrary values x and y on the circle. So if I integrate these guys, I just get a factor of 1/2 for this graph. And that means that the whole space dependency in this theory has gone away for this specific class of diagrams on the circle. But I just have, if I want to, I can now also sum all the ladders for the Malthus-Sander-Wilson loop for the circular operator, and this will just reduce your pure combinatorial problem in taking care of the path ordering which is involved and the group theory factors in evaluating all these diagrams. And if one thinks a bit about it, this is actually best reformulated with the help of the matrix model, which just takes this form here, because the matrix propagator is going to take care of the group algebra, and it will just give you, well, the space-time is gone, and the space sector is gone, and it just gives you the adequate factor, which is modeled here. And this correlator in the Gaussian matrix model can actually be calculated exactly for any lambda and any n, and this is a result. It's just some Laguerre polynomial of degree n in G squared, and if one looks at the asymptotics of that expression, lambda going to infinity and n going to infinity, it just gives me the e to the square root of lambda. So this is the sum of all ladder graphs for the circle. Okay, so for the non-ladders, I had already briefly said that before. What happens is for the line, these two graphs are identically zero. For the circle, the sum of the two is zero. Every graph individually is divergent. I already pointed out that the one-loop self-energy is divergent. And only in omega is equal to two dimensions, the divergences cancel, and one gets zero as a total result. And this is a very subtle cancellation of bulk and boundary divergences, which one sees here, because one has the bulk divergence sitting here in the blob, and one has a boundary divergence, which comes from the sector when these two propagators fall together. And it's, of course, a very interesting question now whether the finiteness of this Malacena-Wilson loop operator persists to all orders, and also whether the non-ladder graphs do not contribute at higher order. And here one already sees a problem with the Drucker-Gross argument that I was telling you just a moment ago, because if I now look at, say, the individual graph here, the self-energy, one loop self-energy, it is exactly equal to zero for the line. However, its image under the inversion on the circle is divergent. So only if I take together diagrams which in the sum are finite, so this sum would be zero, and in the sum here, which is also zero, the argument or the conjecture is at work. So graph by graph is dangerous. Perhaps I can extend it to a sector where I only compare classes of finite graphs. So let's have a closer look at the Drucker-Gross conjecture here. So one statement I want to make is, first of all, the fact that the that W of a line is 1 from the perturbative viewpoint of the gauge theory is not at all obvious, and there's really no proof that is true. But even more importantly, the infinitely extended line is a gauge variant object. It's not closed. It's not gauge invariant, and it's only true in Feynman gauge to this order that we get no contributions. There is actually a gauge that one can choose, sort of conformal gauge, in which this graph equals the graph. So if I go to an alternative gauge here for the infinite line, these two can be made equal to agree. So it is always this statement that a straight line is one is to be taken with a grain of salt, because this is a statement which is gauge dependent.
Why can't you just compactify the thing in a circle so that the line is just a circle and then take the limited radius goes to infinity?
Well, you could do that, but if you do that, you effectively work in a thermal theory, right?
Yeah. I'm confused about the statement that the line does not correspond to a gauge invariant interval. Are you saying that different such regularizations could potentially give different results?
Yes, different gauges will give different results.
For the quantity I'm talking about, different gauges cannot, by definition, give different results. Right?
Why?
If you study the theory on R3 times S1.
Oh, okay. If it's closed.
It's closed.
That I agree. This is
computed. It's gauge invariant to take the limit of the radius of
right.
S1.
But
so now you might say that, okay, but if you regularize it in some other way, in other words, you define a gauge invariant observable
right.
that goes in some other regulator, not the radius of the circle.
Yeah, if you do what you're proposing, you're effectively introducing a temperature in the game,
but
right?
Then I'm removing it.
And then you're removing it. But you can actually show, if you just do the first order computation, that the result is not equal to 1 in that case.
Even in the limit?
Yeah,
of the
order g to the 4, yeah. Because it doesn't depend on the radius. It's a conformal theory. Imagine if this line has extension L is not a scale in the problem. It just factors out. It's gone. So the result of this line is effectively L or length 1. It doesn't depend on that.
So then I'm confused. Why do people use this W of minus 1?
Well, I don't know.
Finite temperature, the free energy of a thing should not.
But in this theory, if I have temperature, it's even temperature is on or it's off. There's nothing else.
Right.
Just zero or one. There is no beta. So that's why the result will act. I can assure you, at order g to the 4, perturbatively, the result will differ. I mean, the result. The result at order G24 will differ in Feynman gauge if I work on R3 cross S1 or R4. So I don't think it's a very useful object actually in R4.
That means no matter how big you make that circle, low frequency gluons or whatever will disturb the answer.
Yeah. Right. Okay, so let me go on. So where was I? Okay, so another essential step in the argument was that vertex graphs do not pick up this conformal anomaly, and that we already saw does not work if I have to deal with divergent graphs. However, I can now show you on the next slide actually an order G6 graph on the circle where that is not true. That is a finite graph on the circle side. Maps to a graph which is zero on the line side. In a weaker version of that conjecture, which is also alluded to in the paper, they say that it could be that the vertex graphs contribute, but that will then result in having a non-Gaussian matrix model description of the situation. That's absolutely correct because that's a rather empty statement. And just keep on modifying my matrix model potential order by order in G just in adjusting that result. So there's not much information because this operator is just a function of N and G. Okay, so here's the example I was wanting to show you. Here's a finite non-vanishing two-loop graph on the circle whose image graph is actually zero. So this is identical to zero, this is finite, and our new PhD student has even managed to compute it. This is the result. And also, I mean, this theta of 3 appearing here does not really look like some combinatorial origin, so it questions this matrix model picture quite strongly. But this is only one graph. I mean, so definitely the graph-by-graph argument is wrong. It could still be that the overall result, that's the sum of all vertex graphs, cancels. That's still possible. But this graph-by-graph argument is definitely wrong. So what we want to say here is that there's definitely a problem with that conjecture. And it would be very desirable to have a complete G6 computation at one's disposal. Okay, another comment I want to make in this business is that the matrix model conjecture is the result of summing all the ladder graphs, but an immediate question is what about non-perturbative corrections like instantons? And there is a recent paper by Bianchi, Green, and Kovac who claim that for SU2 actually there is a non-vanishing contribution to the circular Wilson loop. So whether that vanishes or not, as one at n equals to infinity, I think is still open. But definitely, the finite end result is not for the matrix model does not reflect these instanton contributions. So, as I said, it would be very desirable to have the circle one order higher because we now found this one finite graph. I can just tell you that's something that we're looking at right now, but we haven't got a complete answer so far. I just wanted to give you a flavor of the computation. So we'll have two-loop self-energy insertions, one-loop vertex corrections, and then these class of graphs here, and all the ladders. The ladders are trivial. These are already solved by the matrix model. We picked out a very specific graph, this one, because all the others turn out to be divergent, actually. So it could still be that the sum of all these, first of all, it would be very nice to see that all these divergences cancel now, and it is still possible that they sum up to zero, but it's not at all obvious at this point. Okay, but that's future stuff. We don't have any results so far. Let me now turn to the third class of geometries, the anti-parallel lines, which correspond to the quark-anti-quark potential in that situation. So if I have sort of a rectangle of length T and width L, and I consider the T is much larger than L limit, one has a supergravity prediction for that correlation function, and it is, I think I had it on before. It has this funny numerical factor up front, again the square root of lambda and T over L. And if we now turn to the weak coupling perturbative side, again, Semenov and collaborators did the computation at order G to the 4 and found that here again the vertices cancel, just as they do for the line and for the circle. But the ladder graphs are now non-trivial, so there really is a non-trivial space dependence in the game. But nevertheless, in the large lambda limit, one can write down a bit, one can solve a Beta-Salpeter equation which performs the sum of all these graphs, from all the planar graphs, and the result one gets in this computation is given by this. So qualitatively, the two agree. We again have a square root of lambda dependence. The T over L is no surprise because that's just the conformal invariance of the theory. But the numerical factor is off. So we have a 1 over pi compared to this 4 pi over gamma 1 quarter to the power of 4. So here we have now have a prediction that if the ADS-CFT correspondence is correct for the situation of two anti-parallel lines, the vertex graphs have to start contributing, or there wouldn't be any room for these two things to agree. So it would be very nice here to do as well a two-loop computation of the next order and see whether at the higher order now we get contributions from the vertex graphs or not. This is also an interesting question because so far, all perturbative calculations have not given us any contributions up to order G to the 4 in this vertex sector, and that would, you know, that would point towards a sort of triviality of these Maldacena-Wilson loops. That is, that they only couple to the free sector of the theory. So, what Matthias and I did is to look at a somewhat different situation, but which is still rich enough to give us information on this anti-parallel line situation. We looked at a geometry of two circles, axisymmetric circles of different radii, R1 and R2, separated by a distance h, in our first paper of opposite orientation, and the next paper then of same orientation. Let me first talk about the case of opposite orientations. So what we're interested in is in the connected correlation function of these two Wilson loops. And then imagine that I take the limit, say I take these two circles of to have the same radius, and then take the limit that R is much larger than H, sort of push them together, then I can identify T with 2 pi R and H with L, and I should be able to extract in that limit the quark-anti-quark potential. Actually, there is also evidence from the supergravity side that this is a good prescription because there also exists a supergravity solution for this geometry, and in this particular limit, this supergravity calculation gives exactly the same value for the Maldacena-Wilson loop operator as the two anti-parallel lines. Why did we prefer this situation? Well, it was technically simpler because a large class of diagrams vanish in this scenario. Let me go not get into this. But it's still non-trivial because these are the graphs we had to look at. So at order G squared and order G to the 4, one only has ladder graphs. The first non-ladder graphs start appearing at order G to the 6. So this is the one-loop self-energy insertion. And all these graphs are non-trivial, and also the free gluon exchange graphs are non-trivial. The others are straightforward to do. So what about finiteness? So this is a two-loop calculation. Nobody has probed finiteness at two loops for these operators. Well, it turns out that finiteness persists. And the way it goes is quite nice because what we call X and H graphs, these two, turn out to be finite, whereas the IY, this graph, is divergent, has a divergent and a finite piece, and the divergent piece is exactly minus one half of a self-energy graph. But this guy has a brother where I swap the Y around, so in the sum, the divergences all cancel. And this is again this bulk boundary, the cancellation of divergences, the bulk divergence sitting here and the boundary divergence picking up when the two propagators come close to each other. Now, we have complete analytic control. I mean, in our result for the lattice sector. So, for example, this, just to impress you a bit, the free gluon exchange graph has this nice form with a D logarithm appearing here. A is some function of R1, R2, and H. For the non-ladder graphs, we don't have full analytic results. We were only able to reduce these integrals to low-dimensional finite integrals, which can't be evaluated further, but can be evaluated numerically to a high precision. And what comes out is that for generic values of R1, R2, and H, these non-ladder graphs do not cancel anymore. And this is actually the first time that has been seen and points towards the non-triviality of these Maldacena-Wilson loop operators. Now, what is nice in our integral representations of these non-ladder graphs is that for specific limits of R1 and R2 and H, we can actually extract analytical results again. So there are various applications that we can now perform with our results. So the first application is the question of the static potential, which I started out with as a motivation for this computation. So the quark-anti-quark potential can be extracted by setting these two radii equal to R and taking T to infinity while sending H to zero. And then I can, you know, I get an expansion in terms of T over L for this correlation function. And so this is the order G squared. This is the order G to the 4. These are just pure ladder graphs. And now in the G to the 6 sector, the ladder graphs turn out to be absolutely dominant. So this is the contribution from the ladders, whereas the non-ladders, so the ladders start out with T over L to the 3 and have a T squared term, a log T, and T squared naked, and then a T log T term, whereas the non-ladder graphs only kick in at this order here, T log T. So they do not cancel. So first of all, it could have been, let me stress that although they do not cancel for generic values of R1, R2, and H, what we saw numerically, it could have been that in this quark-anti-quark, in the static potential limit, that they do cancel. But it turns out they do not cancel also in that limit. And that is now, if one wishes, a check of the ADS-CFT prediction, because we have seen that the sum of all ladders does not give the correct result or the prognosed result from the supergravity side. So indeed, we see that a non-ladder graphs start contributing.
Question. The fixed L and large T, the answer just has to be proportional to T, no?
For fixed
L.
No, this is if you want to exponentiate that now. I think that's what you have in mind. So would you expect that to get...
The energy between the quark pair should just be the coefficient of T in the...
That's right, but it's E. It goes like E to the CT over L.
You're worried about the logarithms.
Yeah, I'm worried about the logarithms.
Yeah, well, they're there.
That's one thing that seems was never really resolved in the literature very well. I mean, the fact is that perturbatively there is, strictly speaking, no good potential. These logs appear.
But conformal invariance tells you that it has to be just 1 over R.
No. What, who tells you that? Who tells you that this correlation function should be writable as an exponential of T over L? It just tells you conformal invariance just tells you that it should depend on T over L, but it could be any function of that.
There has to be an energy for a pair of quarks that you stick into the system.
This problem also exists in the ordinary QCD, and
yeah.
The way the QCD guys resolve this is by some weird prescription where log T of L gets replaced by log T squared. So then the argument is that since I do want something which forms E to the potential times T, I just say that I get some non-analytic behavior in G. guess Dyne invented this in 70.
Yeah, you replace log T over L by log G. That's Dyne and Applequist and so on. It's like early 80s or so. But we didn't understand why they did that.
But I think the idea is you can re-sum higher orders of information.
Yeah, that's what hides behind there, yeah.
So there are logs in every order, and somehow the summing them up changes the log of T over L into log of the coupling constant.
But I think this is not very well understood. I actually talked with phenomenologists who did the two-loop QCD calculation for the quark anti-quark situation, and well, he couldn't really explain to us how the logic goes. Sorry? For the static potential?
I did the one loop.
Yeah, yeah, no. For this guy, I did a three-loop calculation.
Three-loop,
Was it three-loop?
In ordinary ANOs, it starts at three loops.
Was it three loops?
Yeah.
I think it was two loops, actually. Okay.
So what is the bottom line, though? The answer, if you compute for any lambda, does it get to the T or not?
No, I think the answer is what you get. I mean, I don't see any reason why it should go like e to the t.
Because you just finished explaining that it doesn't, but then they tell some story.
Well, people have some the subclass of diagrams and then argued that. But well, I don't understand that.
Technically speaking, it does not exponentiate into the form of the v of L. So something if you want to work it.
But they did something.
I mean, these logarithms are simply there, so technically they are there, and then you can start thinking about what to do with them, but it's simply not true that the result is of the form e to the v of L times t, whatever it is.
Yeah. Okay. So, second application of our results is to study the local operator expansion of such a Wilson loop. That is, if we think of shrinking one of the two circles to zero size while keeping R2 and H finite, one would expect that in such a situation the Wilson loop operator can be approximated a sum, an infinite sum of local operators, which should look something like this here. R1 is its shrinking radius, and these are the local operators, so traces of phi's and a's and so on. And this here up here is the associated scaling dimension of that local operator, delta of k. By plugging this ansatz into the two Wilson loop correlator, one gets these overlapping functions. And from our result, we know this side. We should be able to. We can also compute this side here to leading order. We should be able to retrieve information on the anomalous scaling dimensions of these local operators appearing, and also to see what operators appear in this expansion. So, what happens is that this scaling dimension starts out with a classical dimension, which is just, you know, just given by counting the dimensionalities of the fields, but then there will be anomalous contributions to the scaling dimension proportional to various orders in the coupling constant. And perturbatively, these corrections will show up in terms of logarithms of R in such an expansion here. So to leading order, let me just look at the leading order. So at dimension 2, one has two classes of operators. One are the chiral primary operators, the CPOs, the famous ones, which are given by traces of two scalar fields with a protraction with a trace phi part here. And they are BPS operators and are protected to all orders in perturbation theory, so their scaling dimension is given exactly by 2. And the second operator of classical scaling dimension 2 is the Konishi scalar, which is given by the trace part of this. This guy is unprotected and is known to have order g squared, this correction to its scaling dimension. And by looking at our computation, we can actually see whether this operator appears by studying the question whether logarithmic terms or not appear in our two Wilson loop correlator result in the limit where I shrink one of the radii r1 to 0. And it so happens that these logarithms appear, and actually the coefficient up front here tells us exactly what the scaling dimension is, and that agrees with what has been known in the literature before. And we could also get new results on some higher order operators appear here. So the upshot is that this local operator product expansion of the Wilson loop does contain unprotected operators, the Konishi scalars, and is therefore a non-BPS object. Okay. So,
This is true for circular loop.
This is a circular loop, yeah. This is shrinking the circular loop to zero. So we have this expansion. Okay, so the final and last application of our results is a two-loop test now of the Drucker-Gross conjecture, but not for the situation of a single circle, but of having two circles. And let me just add this, that this Gaussian matrix model conjecture is supposed to also hold for multiply wound or stacked circular loops, which also correspond to higher dimensional representations of the loop operators. So if I had such a situation, say I have one doubly wound and a single wound Malacena-Wilson loop, which sit on top of each other, should be given by this correlation function of a matrix model. Now, we have computed a specific situation where I have two singly wound sitting on top of each other, which should then correspond to this matrix model. For this, we need information on the order g to the 6... the order g to the 6 expectation value for having two Malacena-Wilson loops of same orientation. What I have been telling you before was that we did the calculation with having it oppositely oriented. It turns out that one can actually sort of recycle the results by making use of the fact that if I have two order g to the 6, it lays true that all our results from the oppositely oriented case can be translated into the case of same orientation by just swapping the sign of one radius, R2, and that's due to this relation here, that if I integrate one leg of such a propagator around the loop, it's actually equal to the guy or integrating the other direction with a minus sign and swapping R to minus R. It would be nice to know whether this is true in general. So this is true for the complete result is that the swapping of orientation results in a swapping of the radii. That is true for non-path-ordered graphs. But as soon as I have a path ordering appearing, this result here breaks down, and it would be nice to know whether it still holds. Because for the path-ordered graphs we had in our computation, the two, we had to explicitly check it, and it was true. But we don't have a general argument that it should hold for all path-ordered graphs. So now the big question, what happens to the vertex the non-ladder graphs, the vertex graphs, in our two-loop computations? And I remind you, these were the divergent graphs, which summed up to something finite. And indeed, in the limit R1 is equal to R2 and H to 0, they are zero. Similar, the X and the H graphs, they have the same orientation, they all vanish, and this confirms the matrix model conjecture to two loops for the case of having two loops sitting on top of each other. So that's good news for Gross and Drucker, but I want to remind you of that problem which we have been pointing out, this two-loop graph for the single loop operator. So I would say that after all, it might turn out that the conjecture is true, and that all the interacting graphs for the circle and multiple circles cancel, but I don't think we have a good argument why that is going to happen. So let me close by recapitulating our main results. Well, first of all, we've seen that these Malda-Sena-Wilson loop operators are very interesting objects in this four gauge theory, because we are truly finite, at least also to two loop order. We have seen this, and it would be nice to know or have a proof that that is true to all orders. We have seen at order g to the 6 now that vertex graphs start contributing in specific geometries. If I have oppositely oriented circles, they contribute. Circles of same orientation, if they sit on top of each other, they don't. So these Malda-Sena-Wilson loops are really non-trivial operators. They also couple to the vertex graphs. And that is also necessarily for the situation for the static potential to happen if the ADS CFT prediction is correct, and we've seen that happens at this g to the 6 order. So another result was that we showed that the Konishi scalars, or generally unprotected operators, appear in the local operator expansion of these loop operators, and performed a positive two-loop test of the Drucker-Gross matrix model conjecture for two incident circles. But we also gave some arguments why the some evidence why the existing anomaly arguments are actually troubled. So open problems in this field of research are one thing. It would be definitely nice to have a complete two-loop circle result to see what happens here with this finite graph. Another thing, and that's of course closely related, is that to really prove that only ladders contribute to the circle, it would also be very nice to reproduce this very funny factor here from the gauge theory side in the quark-anti-quark potential. I already said finiteness to all orders, and perhaps more technical comment is that in order to make progress on these questions, perhaps working with supergraphs or other gauges could be helpful, but these issues are certainly under investigation. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you again.